Thanks very much, Shane. Tonight on Arena, Éireann O'Leonard performs live in studio, and Maeve Kennedy brings us to London by book. Elegy will be an evening of reflection and remembrance through music dedicated to those who passed away during the COVID-19 crisis. The event at the National Concert Hall takes place just before the final phase of reopening the country on July the 20th. Undoubtedly, this is a suitable moment to reflect on those we have lost. Performances will come from Chamber Choir Ireland and the Chamber Ensemble, vocalist Rhiannon Giddens, pianist Francesco Chiurisi, baroque violinist Claire Duff, and singer Éireann O'Leonard, who I'm delighted to welcome to studio this evening. We were saying just as we were coming to her, it is a very odd time that we've been going through, Éireann.
It is. It's odd. I think I was telling you this time last year, I was at a Bob Dylan concert in Kilkenny, and I just, I find it hard to understand how much time has elapsed. I imagine everybody does. Mm.
I was saying to you exactly the same thing. I've no sense of this being the middle of July. It could be the middle of any month.
It could be non-month. Mm. It's strange. It's very, very, it's very intangible, isn't it?
A non-month, and it's been a non-month for about 5 or 6 months.
Yeah.
Or something like that.
It's odd. I mean, I went to see my parents in West Cork the day before yesterday. I hadn't seen them since January. And, you know, this is happening to everybody.
Mm.
As a shared strangeness, a shared togetherness in a way, even though people aren't together.
That's funny that you should say that, because I've often wondered in some ways how we managed to maintain a type of togetherness, even though we were told to, even though we all stayed separate in our own houses and our own places in as much as we could. But yet, was there some kind of togetherness there for you despite that?
There was. I mean, you know, I'm a big man for the phone. I'm old school. I like to telephone people.
And it's chat, as you don't do FaceTime, are you?
Oh, I do. I mean, I've been doing that back and forth to the US and other places that I have some work connections. But and my parents got a FaceTime set up recently, just quite recently, and that's been quite an amusement.
Mm.
I guess people younger than my generation are adept at all these other methods of communicating with social media. I think there's an invisible web, isn't there, of goings-ons. But at the same time, there is something obviously missing.
Yeah.
You know, the physical realm. You know, my wife often tells me that when we meet people in a socially distant context, my inclination is to move in close to them. And I didn't even notice that about myself. I wouldn't have thought of myself as touchy-feely that way. But, you know, it's strange.
Yeah, and I know a lot of people have probably said to myself that, you know, FaceTime, I kind of could take it or leave it before all of this. But now I really want the FaceTime. I want to see the face on the other side of the phone.
And, you know, it's hard for some people too. I've been talking to some people involved in education, and they find it very intense. You know, some of them are doing, 5, 6, 7 hours of Zoom a day.
Mm.
I don't know if I could do that.
Yeah,
I mean, that's difficult because, you know, you don't have the kind of, what was it Kavanagh said, the nod and elbow language, you know. You're having to look straight ahead, and so there's no context.
Mm.
And, you know, I think that requires an unusual and perhaps unnatural degree of concentration. And I don't know. I mean, it's great. I love seeing my mom and dad on FaceTime, but I don't want to be doing Zoom. I mean, I don't want to be. I guess I'm not doing it, but I do feel for people who are.
And who have to.
Yes, who have to.
You are going to be singing to an empty concert hall this coming Friday evening,
yeah.
which is what they've been doing. I mean, they're fabulous to watch. There's no question about that. But I still can't get my head around what it must be like for the performer to stand up there with little, you know, very few people in the hall, and that you're trying to communicate out even beyond the hall into somewhere else.
Well, I haven't experienced it, actually. I've done a few things that have been organised in a post or a kind of a COVID social distancing manner, but they've been in large rooms where there wasn't any evidence of it being a performance space, like the National Gallery and so forth. So this is unusual because also I probably I know the hall quite well. And I mean, I kind of have performed there sometimes, emptiness, into when you do sound checks, you know. And you it's also a bit odd, but it will be I imagine that that part of me will be struggling with stopping myself from kind of watching myself, you know, studying myself as I perform into the space, because you don't really want to get distracted by the strangeness. But I think it will be suffused with some strangeness.
Well, perhaps the sound check, whatever the time that you get, you know, to be on the, it will be a different from a sound check where, you know, okay, later on there'll be an audience here. You know, later on it's going to be like this, but I need to give it the full welly. Maybe the sound check will be a different process now.
Yeah, I'm wondering what will happen there. I mean, normally with sound checks, you're there with a couple of tech people, and I know who they're going to be, as it turns out, which is great because I haven't seen them in quite a long time. Makes you feel like you actually have some sort of purpose to be with these wonderful tech people. My manager engineer will be there and so forth. But it will be odd, I'm pretty sure. But at the same time, I was thinking on the way up, it's an interesting, it's a metaphor, it's a mirror, it's appropriate that we should be alone, because so many people are and have been. And so I think it's right that I should be confronted with that small bit of strangeness to understand, maybe. I mean, I have a wife and three children and three cats and a dog and a horse, and, you know, I'm not alone.
You haven't been totally alone during lockdown period. Yeah.
At all. Unless you regard, as one might, that I've been splendidly alone with my family in the middle of nowhere. But like, there are people who are actually, I mean, it's even hard to say it without feeling some emotion, that they're so alone. Particularly, I mean, I was listening to a politician on Drive Time on the way up, and he was saying, you know, that a lot of people who go to pubs in rural Ireland, they are loners, you know, they're people who live alone. And they've really been pushed into a super solitary space by this event.
And people perhaps who have lost somebody very close to them,
yes,
and been left absolutely alone.
And then
little or no facility to grieve or to mourn, to even have a funeral.
Well, exactly. This entire process has been, or was, is, remains to a large extent withdrawn from the other processes of what we regard as being human. And I think it is a new situation. And I do feel for those people. And I think the event is about that too, about the fear of aloneness and of the aftermath of aloneness. And if we can somehow or other acknowledge it, because I think it's something, you know, you go around your day. I've been busy enough doing various things. And, you know, I'm sure I haven't really given much thought, because, you see, the thing is that it's kind of happening out there.
You can't
touch it. I mean, I actually don't know anybody who's got the virus. But I know there are people who do. So it's very odd, isn't it?
I'm wondering then, the choice of lament that you're performing on Friday night, did it jump out at you?
Well, I gave the director of the evening two options, and I think we settled on this one because of its provenance, I suppose. I also had some experience with it over the many years as a ritual type of song sung in a church, and not just in Coolé where I grew up, but I've sung it elsewhere. I might be asked to do that, and so it had a resonance for me in terms of my own memory of events to do with marking the passing of people. I mean, on a funny aside, you know, if there can be fun found in these things, it wasn't everybody it was sung for, curiously.
Oh, you had to be special to get this song for
like,
you, did you?
That to me seems to be an indisputable fact.
Yeah.
But I've never got to the bottom of why that is.
Ishley Lumps the Shallot is how you refer to the song, which are the first three words of the song. Listen to me for a bit, I suppose, is what you're saying, really, isn't it?
That's right. It's a kind of a, listen, I want to tell you about this person. And then the images are very, they're larger than the human scale. The person is buried with his horse and his chariot. And I mean, in all likelihood, this piece is approximately 200 years old, but the mythos embedded in the lyric is given the power of a much more ancient set of sort of visual metaphors.
Right, well, let's hear a bit. You're going to sing a few verses for us.
Yes, now I have a little drone-making machine here.
Oh, yes, you have that.
So not to frighten people.
Yeah, little harmonica beside you.
It's known as a shruti.
A shruti? Okay.
Yeah, it's an Indian instrument. In fact, I bought it in New York some years ago, but it just does something like this. Ishti glum so shalut guno so div ker kaluk gorbe shanotir uchlano Scontracht Erchim.
Wow, that is extraordinary. So I've got an Il Makatha Shin Irla. That's a section from H.D. Lumps of Shallot, the Irla O'Leonard, part of what he'll be performing on this coming Friday in the National Concert Hall as part of an event called Elegy. Sean, this text came in while you were singing, by the way. Sean, credit and thanks to Irla for his perceptive comments from someone who's been on my own since Friday, March the 13th, says Anne, in Dublin 13. So you obviously hit a chord there.
Well, I mean, look, I think everybody's trying to feel it. I mean, your own broadcasting organisation, Joe Duffy, for example, doing phenomenal work. The whole way people have rearranged their work practices. And, I mean, this is another invisible sort of network. I mean, I was able to go to Aldi. I was able to go here and there. Where did all the food come from? Mm-hmm. You know?
Didn't get there by itself.
No. Ploughing continued. Hay cutting continued. Deliveries continued. In fact, I think it's important to note that the people we normally, you know, don't perhaps get included in the national conversation are the very people who keep the engine running when the rest of us take what has been, for some of us, a longish holiday.
Have you got any work done in the period?
Well, the first thing I did when I came home, I was living in America for a period of the year, and I came home in March the 1st. And my wife has a horse, and the stables where she kept the horse was about in a place called Greignamana, a lovely place, and we used to go there kind of twice a day, or Emer would, and we had to move him near home because of the new restrictions. But luckily, we were able to rent a field near us, but the only problem was that there was a ditch between us and the field. So the first job I had to do was to break open the ditch and hang a gate. And I had very good neighbours who helped me. But actually, I've been quite busy. I've been, luckily, again, in my own case, perhaps even I wouldn't have focused quite as much on it. I've been writing a new album, which I've been working quite hard on. I'm about halfway into it. And I had other things to record as well, things that were sort of on the back burner for a while. I had to finish a project for Linda Buckley, the Irish composer. And I'm still continuing to prepare for a recording with your own concert orchestra here for a project by Neil Martin involving Seamus Heaney's text, Sweeney Astray. Mm. Half of it is done. Everything is done except my last half, which is actually a quarter, if you like, if you get me. So I have enough to be doing, but I was lucky that I was able to do it from home, Sean, you know.
Yeah. Now, I'm putting you on the spot here. Would you have another little bit of something that you could finish up with for us?
I suppose I could.
Yeah, you have a little thing there. And Nurtatu, a chap who went in, Vishishin Dreikthul, Maihua Irla. At Sean Vishishin Dreakthil is the text that came in there. Magical. And that's exactly what it was. Let me just tell, are you thinking of something there? I mean, you're happy to go with something?
I could do, yeah.
Yeah, okay. Well, you do that and let me tell people about Friday night's event. Bieber Pascalia in G minor. Claire Duff will be playing that in baroque violin. Wayfaring Stranger, Rhiannon Giddens and Francesco Teresi. Rhiannon singing, Francesco on the piano. H.D. Lumps is Shallad. We heard a little section of it earlier on from Irla. He'll be singing that completely and in full on Friday evening. And then Foray's absolutely magical, equally magical Requiem will be sung by the Chamber Choir of Ireland. And what a way that is to remember all of those who lost their lives. What are you going to finish up with for us?
This is rather unexpected. So I'll just see. This thing won't do what I want, so I'll just do it myself probably.
Oh, there's a wee change of note. Has it done it for you?
I think I'll do it without it, actually.
Okay.
Because it's misbehaving, a bit like myself. I'll sing you something from the singing of my great aunt Elizabeth Cronin, and this is actually a song about being alone, as it turns out. And so people will know her. She was collected by Alan Lomax in 1952, down in West Cork. And this is from my mom, who is in fine fettle, thank God.
And will Tanamir now?
On Tanamir and Tavron, not time Korhovim Aenrim Lee. I'm weary from lying alone.
Lovely.
Tranon in deun smedolo valkerot Shad yarko sun spare van queeru distriesel fend ker lover she iskeluam Time coro vemener omly and 11 years along I am weary from being alone. I am weary from being
I can't believe that you did that. I really put you on the spot live on radio. Thank you so much. Sean, I hope before I die, I see that wonderful man perform live. I'm only 68. You've loads of time, Pauline. But I think that he has the most amazing, wonderful voice a human being could have. And I agree with all he said on the lockdown. Pauline in County Limerick. Hopefully you will get lots of opportunity to see him in the years ahead, Pauline. But you can see him online this Friday evening. Tom Coruva in Arimali, Weary from Lying Alone was the song that you heard there. But he'll be performing as part of Elegy. Streams live this Friday, the 17th of July at 8 p.m. from the National Concert Hall. You can get that on the Concert Hall's YouTube channel, as well as on irishtimes.com and rte.ie. Gormil Magadela. Well, what a response there was to Irla Linard and those two spellbinding performances. Sean, saw Irla at Boris Festival a few years ago. Was the most spellbinding musical performance I ever experienced. Can't wait to see him live. Such a special talent, says Lorraine in Thurles. And lots of people responding to that amazing singing and amazing way of philosophising actually around the whole COVID experience for all of us. To date, on our Monday Literary European City Break series, we've been to Venice, Paris, Amsterdam and Berlin. Tonight we're off to London with Maeve Kennedy. Now, if the novel was a largely English form to begin with, save perhaps Don Quixote in Spain, then there's no shortage of fiction to choose from right back to the early 1700s when it comes to London. And in fact, it is the early 1700s that Maeve is going to start with. She's joining me now, I presume, from London City. You're a Dubliner by birth, Maeve. London is your adopted city. Obviously a city, yeah, city well documented in fiction, no doubt about that. Dickens, Aykroyd, characters like Sherlock Holmes, Paddington Bear, could go on. Now, this is not an exhaustive list, but you're bringing us right back to 1700 and a novel published in 1722. The title tells us why, perhaps.
It does. A Journal of a Plague Year. Actually, I'm a very homesick Dubliner, I have to say, listening to Irla's glorious voice. I've been living here since 1987, but it's the longest I've been out of Dublin since I moved here, and I miss it terribly. A Journal of a Plague Year was published in 1722, but it is set in one of the great plagues of London in 1665 by Daniel Defoe. Now, Defoe, in some ways, was a bit of a rogue. He was a real hack journalist, and he had the great good luck for a hack journalist to live through interesting times. He lived through the Great Fire of London. He lived through a terrible storm in 1703. He lived through various royal and parliamentary reshuffles, but he was only five.
I was going to say, he was born in 1660. Now, even the best hack journalist, best hack journalist doesn't have anything at five. Where did he get his information?
This is the kind of book, you know, that if it was published now, there would be a 5,000 word denunciation of it in some literary journal as something that was being passed off as fact and was fiction. He had an uncle called Defoe, a slightly less grand version of the name than his own. And his uncle was a saddler living in East London. And he seemed to have drawn very heavily on the uncle's reminiscences. And what he's writing about, that the parallels are just so eerie. When the plague starts, the first report they hear of the plague is not in 1665, but in 1664. And I was thinking of me listening on the World Service in the small hours of the morning to the stories of this very peculiar virus breaking out in China. And I was listening to those reports last December, you know, before the first cases in Europe. I'm thinking, this doesn't sound very good. So Defoe says that the first reports came from the continent, from Holland, and it seems that the government had a true account of it, and several councils were heard about ways to prevent its coming over, but all was kept very private. And I think there's some agreement here that the government handling of this one has been pretty nearly as bad as in the attempts in 1665 to keep the plague out.
Yeah, in the UK you're talking about there. And the other parallels that I think, one very particular one that you drew is between the terrible situation with burials back at the time of the Great Plague and the situation more recently with COVID-19.
Well, I live in West London, and Defoe is writing about East London, and he describes a particularly hideous plague pit that was dug in the churchyard of its local church, as he says, his uncle's local church, St. Botolph's. And it was an enormous plague pit. It was like, you know, it was like a valley, he says. And they thought it would last them for months. And actually, they filled it up in a fortnight. The bodies of the dead were arriving in carts at night, and they were just tipped from the tail of the cart into this enormous trench, lit by candles set around the edge. Well, about 300 yards, I'd say, from the pit that Defoe is describing, there was an undertaker that specialised in Muslim burials. And it was terribly sad for some of London's peoples who believe in very quick funerals, very quick burials. And these were impossible. And they were literally stacking up the bodies in temporary refrigerated shelving because they couldn't get the coffins made fast enough and they couldn't get the crematorium slots fast enough. Where I am, on the other side of the city, people were complaining of a strange humming noise at night that was keeping them awake. And this turned out to be the refrigerated units in the parking lot of the big hospital about half a mile from where I live, which were working away all night. Defoe also describes how people walked down the middle of the streets because they didn't want to walk on the pavements and they didn't want to go near the houses. And that was such a striking thing here in London, as the streets literally emptied. And I walked myself down the middle of the streets. Now, with tarmac, the streets weren't turning green with grass, as Defoe describes, but they were so empty of traffic that people were walking in groups down the middle of the road because there wasn't room on the pavements to pass. You know, one person and a buggy, and that was the pavement done. And you could hear voices from two, three streets away. Wow. You could hear birds singing from hundreds of yards away because there was no traffic. There were no planes, which in London is a huge thing, obviously. And it was as quiet and as eerie as in Defoe's days.
Okay, so that's the first of the three novels that you have, for some very obvious reasons why a journal of the plague year, even though it goes right back to the 18th century or to the 16th century, that it should speak so much to today. But let's move on to novel number two, if we can. And again, there's a very personal connection to this, which is what we're looking for in some ways when you're choosing your books for particular cities. It's your own connection to that city as much as it is anything else. This has to do with not a plague this time, but fog is the big thing in Marjorie Allingham's novel, The Tiger in the Smoke.
Tiger in the Smoke is a fabulous book. I discovered when I was rereading it for this, it's actually J.K. Rowling's favourite detective novel, which I hadn't known. It was published in 1952. But it was written in 1951, and it's generally agreed that 1951 was the last of the great London fogs, which came down like a yellow blanket over the city, wiped out all sound, wiped out all sense of direction. Now, there is a very personal connection with this, because in 1951, my mother was living and working in London, and she was caught in one of these smogs, which came down when she had been at a concert in the Albert Hall, and she was trying to get across to the other side of Hyde Park, back to her home in Bayswater, and she got completely lost. She said she could hardly see her hand in front of her face, and she could hear nothing. There was hardly anyone on the streets. And a man stepped out of a doorway, asked her where she was going to. She told him. These were innocent times, Sean. And he walked her back. He knew how to steer her back to her doorstep in Bayswater, brought her back to the doorstep of her flat, tipped his hat to her and said goodnight. She said she never even saw his face properly, and she never saw him again.
And I guess that mirrors the types of acts of kindness that we've seen in recent times here as well. But the novel itself, what story is it telling? I often think when you're telling a story, when you're telling a story that's in the fog, what can you show?
It's bleak enough. This is immediately post-war London, which to a strange extent survived into the first time I was in London in the 1960s, when the place was still spattered with bomb sites. And indeed, part of Soho was closed off about 2 months ago when they found an enormous still active flying bomb on a building site in the middle of Soho. So this isn't just ancient history, but this is post-war London. It's poor. It's battered. A lot of it is falling down. And it's full of people who are living on their wits after the war. Pretty much everybody has been affected one way or another. The smoke, obviously, is the fog. The tiger is a psychopath, a real genuine psychopath, who has just managed to break out of prison by murdering his unfortunate prison psychiatrist who thought he had a handle on him. And in this world where nobody can see where they're going, the people who have a mental map of the city in their heads are the winners, and the criminals. The cops to a certain extent, but the criminals are the ones who really do know their way around. And there are extraordinary scenes. There are extraordinary descriptions that could be Defoe. I'm sure Allingham is right. At Marble Arch, they have set up braziers, blazing fiery braziers, because they work better than streetlights to show you your way through the fog. And this terrifying gang, it's a sort of street musician gang, but they're hardly musicians. I mean, they've hardly got two legs and two arms between them. They've all been battered to pieces by the war, but they are absolute villains, and they are living in a terrifying cellar under one of the London markets. And they can find their way by the smell of the streets around the city. And terrible things are happening in the fog.
All right. you sold to me anyway. The Tiger in the Smoke by Marjorie Allingham. Your final choice then, Maeve, more contemporary book. And again, an interesting mix here. A woman born in Scotland, Aminata Forner, her father from Sierra Leone originally. In fact, when the family returned there, he was imprisoned and eventually hanged for his political activity.
Yeah, there's a lot of politics in the background of the plotting of this book. I mean, there are parts of this book that are set in 19th century America, contemporary Africa, Sierra Leone, Bosnia. But I think at its core, this is a great London book, because the map of the city is the bone structure of this book.
And given that we've had a plague and a fog, I'm presuming a title like Happiness. Are we in a nicer place?
Well, this is a very rare contemporary novel, Sean, that has a happy ending. You don't get a lot of them for your money these days. She wrote it 2 years ago. What's, I think, wonderful about it is part of it is a kind of detective story. It's a search for a lost child. It's about the tribes of London, many of whom are invisible to most of the people who live there. The traffic wardens, the hotel doorkeepers, the sweepers, the dust car keepers, the park wardens, who all know one another, but they're not noticed, they're hardly spoken to by most Londoners. And the animals that live in the city, they're very much part of the plot. The screaming green parakeets, of which we have flocks around where I live. You know, you're sitting in a very English park and suddenly a jungle flock flies over your head, screaming like banshees and flashing like emeralds. And the urban foxes, which I saw some fabulous fox photographs from Dublin in the lockdown, they're all over London. And yeah, they rule the place. They're the ones who know how to survive.
Is the London that Aminata Forna describes in 2018, is it a very recognisable London? Is it the same London as Defoe described back in the 17th century, 18th century?
I mean, what's interesting about these three books is that they almost precisely span 300 years, and there are parts of it that are instantly recognisable. The Old Kent Road was a place where people were ducking and diving and living on their wits in Defoe's day, and it is still in this book. And of course, the Thames threads its way through these three books. The Thames is such an important way of finding your way, and it carries such a freight of history. The Thames is crucial to this, but there are wonderful scenes in the car park underneath the National Theatre and in the kitchen of the Savoy Theatre. And one of the things I loved about it is that the doorkeeper from the Savoy is explaining incredulously to the police and the parking attendants and the various other people who work these streets. He's explaining to them that there's a huge juicing machine in the Savoy kitchen because many of the millionaires who stay there will eat nothing but juiced tropical fruits. And they think, but if you could have anything, why would you drink juice?
just before I give those three books then as your final choice, I wanted you to tell me a little bit, maybe London is opening up again bit by bit. You paid a recent visit to the National Gallery there. What was that experience like? Very different post-lockdown?
Boy, was I thinking of Defoe in that, I have to say. I went into a private view before the gallery opened. It's sparkling. My God, you could lie down and eat your dinner off any of the floors. It is absolutely gleaming. But there's a one-way trail through it. There are huge empty spaces. They've had to close all the small rooms because there's no way to, you know, one person in that would be too many people in some of the small rooms. So they've moved pictures into some of the big central galleries. It's still free, of course, but you have to book your place in advance. And what was really eerie about it was because the centre of London is only gradually coming awake, the whole area around the National Gallery was dead as an old turnip. The director of the gallery told me that he thought the day before opening, he'd go out and get himself a sandwich from Pret on the corner and walked out and he discovered that all the sandwich bars were closed.
Wow.
And he had to come back and he told me get a sandwich from his own canteen. It's the strangest feeling. I mean, when I was walking across Trafalgar Square, there were pigeons and there were perhaps 20 people, no more. And all the surrounding cafes, bars, everything closed.
All right. Well,
the souvenir stalls.
A new normality, I suppose, is descending upon us. That's Maeve Kennedy. And thanks very much. Good to talk to you as always, Maeve. And Maeve's three London books are A Journal of the Plague Year, that's by Daniel Defoe, The Tiger in the Smoke from Marjorie Allingham, and Happiness by Aminata Forna. Next Monday, we're off to Prague with John Banville. The Resistance is the name of the collaborative musical project founded 2 years ago by author and spoken word performer Peter Murphy, guitarist Dan Comerford, and four members of the German-Irish drum crew Blocko Garman. On Friday of next week, the combination of all those talents will release their eponymous debut album under the title Cursed Murphy versus The Resistance. Peter Murphy, I suppose the aforementioned Cursed Murphy in some ways, is with me now and we'll be talking about the music and the words in a minute. I want to play a track just to start, but before we go to the track, which is called Burn Hibernia Burn, did you have Burn Hollywood Burn from Public Enemy 1990, the rap band? Was that in your mind?
Unashamedly, yeah, I'm a huge Public Enemy fan. In fact, the track we're about to play began life before we ran into the drummers. It was just me and Dan, and by way of rhythm, we were using Fight the Power, the rhythm track, as the as the loop. And the first rehearsal we had with the drummers, it was basically, can you give us a Public Enemy breakbeat?
So it is, it's an homage to Public Enemy.
Yeah. Which is like the posh way of saying a Blatant Steel.
Okay. Blatant Steel, stroke homage, make your choice. Cursed Murphy, Burn Hibernia Burn. Burn Hibernia Burn from Cursed Murphy and the debut album, which is about to be released, Cursed Murphy versus the Resistance. I was asking you, Peter, as we were listening to that, it is a great drum beat. I'm not surprised that you wanted to use it, no doubt about that. I was asking you, had you recorded the album pre the lockdown? And you had, but you said you had to socially distance because of that drum beat in some ways.
Well, all our rehearsals are socially distant on account of the volume between, spare thought for me, I've got Dan Comerford's amp on one side of me and those four on the other. It's, if the volume don't get me, the plague will. But I know we recorded it over the last year and we were ready to go in May, but then the COVID hit, obviously. Mm. Artlinks, who is an initiative run by the arts department in Wexford, and they cover Kilkenny, Wexford and Waterford. They're an amazing organisation, but they fund visual arts and theatre and literature, but also music. So they kicked in, they awarded us a grant, which helped with the recording costs, and we began recording it. The only way to record the drummers is live in a room with stone walls and wood floors. And then we continued on with our friend Johnny Fox, who's an amazing songwriter and plays with bands like The River Fane and Jerry Fox Sailing. And he put out an album last year called Aguas, all in Portuguese. Johnny is an incredible musician, but he also built his own studio from the ground up. So he was kind of the co-producer. And we were in this amazing position of having him in a studio, but also like somebody who's incredibly technically minded, but a musician in his own right. So I just wanted to shout out to Johnny because he's an incredibly talented man. So that there was this crew of us basically making this record.
Well, for the past year or so. I'm interested, though, if you listen to your own lyrics and you think back to seeing, as you've acknowledged, that influence from Public Enemy and Burn Hollywood Burn. Not long afterwards, we're talking about the Rodney King case and we're talking about Los Angeles. If not Hollywood, it was burning. There were riots. And you're talking about here, the tide will rise like a leviathan. There'll be looting. There'll be rioting. The poles will flip. The seas will surely churn. And come judgment day, in every street, you'll heed this jihad on repeat. Do you think we're at a on the cusp of something quite momentous like that, quite revolutionary?
It's funny. I mean, I had this title in 2010 or 11, and it was like stuck on the wall, and I was writing a kind of bunch of dystopian short stories, and I thought I was writing a novel around it. I don't know why it was just in the air, particularly after the snow, and people had come through a sort of crippling austerity, and there was a real sense that we were living in some sort of Soviet-era dystopian fiction. But history is cyclical. Unfortunately, I'm not sure. I'm strictly non-violent. That's the only song on the album where I'm actually singing in character or as a kind of character. The rest of it is quite autobiographical, and it's not particularly hard to fathom what the songs are about. But that was like touching into something, an anger in the country, and certainly it feels timely with what's going on in the States at the moment, but also feels timely here in terms of, we've a lot of people calling themselves patriots or nationalism has come back in a strange conspiracy theorist frothing at the mouth, oddball, 5G sort of weirdness. There's a very extremism, I suppose, is the word I'm looking for. There's a lack of dialogue and patience and hearing each other out. And that kind of fanaticism or extremism, I find incredibly...
Extremism of any kind, on any side.
On any side, I find incredibly worrying because, you know, consensus is the key to peace. Post-COVID, we had a whole different kind of dystopia kicking in. I don't know if this country, given what we've been through, is ever going to, you know, go through a bloody revolution. But there seems to be certainly a revolution in terms of consciousness, in terms of going, what kind of society do we want to have? You know, if it's possible to helicopter money into people's bank accounts to save them misery, like, why can't we do this all the time? So there is a sense of old thinking or old things being torn down, whatever the shape of the new thing is.
Whatever that's going to be. Now, I should say, you will be performing live, is it to an empty art centre?
Yes.
on the 24th of July, and that'll be the launch of the album.
But
I want to finish up with the second track on the album, and perhaps this has more of a sense of something more personal within it and something more, I suppose it's positive, that the challenge can be positive. Climb,
that came out of, like, in many ways, you know, the title of the album, Curse of Murphy versus the Resistance. I mean, the Resistance very much militant, you know, there was always a militant kind of wartime feel off the drums and the sound and even the look of the band. But it also has a kind of a personal thing in that Resistance can be self-sabotage. It can be the thing that keeps you from doing exactly what you want to do. And Climb is kind of about that. A lot of people were saying during the COVID, we released it, we'd always intended to. Actually, we hadn't. We were unsure as to what the next single was going to be. And then we listened to Climb and thought about where people's heads were at and how they felt. And we shot the video in quarantine. We just shot it on our phones and sent all the footage to Dan, who edited it into this video. That, I mean, a lot of it is personal, and it's about overcome. It's about, look, if you want it in a nutshell, the whole album's about refusing to roll over.
Yeah, don't roll over. Climb, as the track tells you.
I know you think that you don't have the stuff. The heart is snarling on its leash. Here's where you've arrived. Here's where you're alive. You're paralyzed with mania, with rage. Better place than this. And though this way is strange for us, I know this path is dangerous. I know that you've been...
And Climb, that track there from the new album Cursed Murphy and the Resistance. And Cursed Murphy and the Resistance is also the name of the band, and the debut album of the same name will be released in full Friday next, July the 24th, same evening. You can catch the band performing live, streaming date at the Wexford Arts Centre. Go to the Instagram page of Arts Links to find out more about that and to see it. In fact, that is our lot for this evening. Liam Murphy and Paula Shields researched. Dave Gibson was on sound this evening. The broadcast coordinator was Janice Furphy. And tonight's programme was produced by Sinead Egan. I will talk to you tomorrow night once again here on RT Radio 1, 7 o'clock.